KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.
A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail?
Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. So, it kind of goes without saying, have you seen the films of Jeff Nichols? Have you seen Shotgun Stories or Take Shelter or Mud? Or maybe even his newest film, Loving? He has a tendency as a writer-director to take people undergoing almost traumatic, extraordinary situations and take them through their everyday life. I think it's something that's unique to him. And I've actually talked to him about it many places except for here. So right. Now I get a chance to talk to him about it here. His new film, by the way, is Loving. First of all, Jeff, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me.
No, of course. And that is something. I think I've brought this up to you many times, but it's fascinating to me that that's your affinity for getting into these stories that are almost all, not almost, so they're all about a trauma.
Right.
Sometimes from another planet. Sometimes the threat of the end of the world. In fact, almost in some way, it's almost always the threat of the end of the world, either literally or metaphorically for your characters.
That makes it sound much more commercial than they ever end up being. But and oddly enough, they're also always attached to family. So I don't know what relationship family and the end of the world have, but I've seemed to find it in four, now going on five films.
Yeah, but it's also about families drawing together, being able to becoming closer.
Certainly.
And proximity as well as sort of figuratively. And sometimes that drawing together literally creates for tensions.
Right. Well, and, you know, and it speaks to your kind of opening statement. You're looking as a filmmaker for two things at once, which are very hard to balance, which is universality and specificity all at the same time. And the way that I get to universality is to talk about specificity and to look at the details in people's lives, the textures, and sometimes the mundane processes that they go through. Those are the things I think that define us and define our relationship to the world and to each other. And in an odd way, more so than, you know, trying to tackle, I don't know, really big ideas with really big speeches and in a really big way, that in a strange way seems to distance people from maybe what you're trying to do. Whereas I think if you can look at the day-to-day parts of people's lives, you have a better shot of connecting with, you know, a larger swath of people.
Are there things in your life that drew you to this rather than being influenced by, because it's the influence of European film on you as much as anything, obviously.
Yeah, you know, it's literature more than film.
I mean, it feels like European film, but it's certainly literature, certainly short stories, I would say.
You know, when my dad first read, he reads all my scripts, he read the script for Mud, and he said, it's very literary. That's actually what he said for Shotgun Stories. And he didn't necessarily mean it as a compliment, you know?
how did he mean it?
You know, we gathered together our family's money to make my first film. It was about $48,000. A grandmother had passed away and left my mom some that she gave to me. You know, it was that old story of just kind of pulling your resources. And my dad was a big fan of, like, why don't you write like a comedy or maybe a horror movie?
And he's still waiting.
We might actually make some of this money back, which we never did. And and I said, but Dad, I want to make this film. And he said, well, it's very literary. And so ultimately it was a compliment, I think, and it's proven to put me in pretty good stead, you know, throughout my career. But there was a big sea change for me in college. I was kind of a late bloomer when it came to reading. I read a ton of comic books growing up. I mean, it was, you know, that's where I was getting my vocabulary. And without a doubt, probably had some big influences on the way that my brain processes, you know.
What comics were you reading, I have to ask?
Oh, gosh. Well, I read Batman religiously, but I was also in the infancy of Image Comics coming out with
a little over 25 years ago.
Spawn, Wildcats, and everything else. So, yeah, you know, I was right there, late 80s, early 90s. And
so big, those are like big action comics, all those
guys. Yeah, yeah. X-Men, you know, Wolverine, Punisher, all those guys were on my plate. I rarely dabbled in the Sandman, you know, universe and the headier comics.
It's
my brothers
It's
would
funny because
do that.
From looking at your movies, you would think that that sort of that stuff, that kind of Vertigo Sandman stuff would have been the influence on you. And in fact, it's the more mainstream stuff.
It, you know, you could say the same for films as well. You know, I was a suburb kid. Like, I was growing up with a pretty standard, you know, suburb American education in terms of film and comic books. And so it wasn't until I got to college that a few really big things started to happen. There are kernels of it in high school with, you know, reading my first Flannery O'Connor short story or, you know, I remember, though, being challenged with Go Down Moses by Faulkner and just being completely lost. But
he was too.
I didn't figure that book out until really my late 20s. But, you know, in college, you go to film school, you don't know anything about making movies. Coming from Arkansas, I didn't know anything. I'd never been on a film set. So I start learning the technical aspects, but at some point somebody's going to ask you, well, what story do you want to tell? And you have to start thinking about yourself in an interesting way, and what do you want to bother people with for 2 hours? And I started thinking a lot about the fact that I was a Southerner. I started thinking a lot about my family. But at the same time, I'm introduced to contemporary Southern writers like Larry Brown and Harry Cruz, which oddly enough led me to Raymond Carver. And
but all these things you're talking about have a Gothic streak in them. I mean, be it contemporary Gothic,
right?
In the case of Cruz or Brown, or old-fashioned Gothic of Faulkner and Flannery O'Connor.
Yeah, these were the things I was drawn to. And oddly enough, I've never, you know, Gothic is a term that's always been a bit evasive for me. I see things I recognize in those stories. You know, those are the things I respond to. In Larry Brown's stories, I saw relatives or I saw people that I encountered in Southeast Arkansas, and I said, yeah, that's representative of something truthful that I've laid my eyes on or heard, that type of voice or accent.
We can say, though, something else that unites these stories in your movies, too, is a sense of dread.
For sure. And, you know, I don't know where that comes from necessarily, probably also from my dad. He's a bit of a conspiracy theorist and, you know, and a bit of a kind of libertarian. And I think, I don't know, there's some floating anxiety is the way he always used to describe it in my family. With Loving, though, it was an interesting fit. And I'm trying now that I'm on this kind of press circuit to decode how much is really part of Richard and Mildred's story and how much is part of my, you know, affectation. I'm just trying to be fair in the analysis. But there is a whole section of this film that is just about dread. It's about a psychological threat. But it makes a lot of sense when you...
I think there's a visual component. By the way, it's a treatment. We're talking about dread and then everything that Rising must converge with my guest, Jeff Nichols, whose new film is Loving. But there's a moment in Loving... And we should say it's the story of Richard and Mildred Loving, who ended up becoming part of the epic landmark Supreme Court case that ended what used to be called, a word that they hate in my family, miscegenation, with mixed race marriages in the United States. But there's a moment in this movie that, for me, kind of encapsulates everything you've done. When Richard is working under a car and he's by himself and we hear these voices around him and the car feels like this physical force that could drop on him at any moment.
That's interesting. It's very similar to when people talk about Shotgun Stories, my first film, and they're like, every car door that slams, you feel like that there's going to be an attack after it. Because early in that film, in Shotgun Stories, I put this scene of a altercation at a graveside service. And I don't think narratively—
Which could come right out of Faulkner.
Right, for sure, for
or
sure.
Or Harry Cruz, for that matter.
That's true. It actually came out of a Drive-By Trucker song. But the, you know—
Same thing.
Same thing. It's all, we're all reading the same stuff. But you know, what I didn't fully realize narratively at that point in my career was the energy that was going to, you know, propel through the rest of that narrative. I was just doing character development then, you know, in scenes after that. And everybody's just waiting for that other shoe to drop. And they're saying, when's this going to come back? Because we know it's going to come back. And then I take 30 minutes just to build character and everybody's on the edge of their seats. But that, you know, that was something I'll at least give myself credit for noticing it when I started showing people the film and seeing the effect that it had on them. And that was far more calculated in Take Shelter. Mud is a bit of an anomaly there. Midnight Special, it is certainly calculated. And in Loving, it's calculated. The interesting thing with Loving, though, it is, in my opinion, representational of more than just the character experience. It almost seems like, you know, the experience of so many people in the Black community in the South during the Jim Crow South. It seemed to represent one of the more insidious parts of the whole thing, which is constant threat. You know?
Not a constant threat, but an institutional threat, which is worse than a constant threat.
Absolutely.
Because the dread that you dealt with in your other movies is a kind of nameless dread
right.
that is existential,
right.
fantastical in some way. This is a real-life thing that exists that is a part of the way people deal with the world every single
100%.
Day.
100%. And in this particular situation, you know, you have a male white character who, despite, you know, being in a lower socioeconomic status, very easily could partake in privilege and has made decisions in his life that put him in a situation where he does not get that privilege anymore. And so it extends that point of view, I think, to a part of the audience that maybe never sees that in their own versions of themselves on screen, you know. And I find that pretty fascinating. But that it's all mixed up with what I think was representational of what the Lovings were going through, representational of what was happening in the Jim Crow South, but then also, like you're saying, all of this stuff that is in my wheelhouse as a storyteller. It's odd when you have this kind of convergence of things as a storyteller.
Yeah, but I guess I just think, too, that almost nameless fear is everything you've made so far led you up to doing this. This couldn't have been even your second or third film because the last time I saw you when we screened Mud at the museum, and I was just talking about the amount of time you really took. I mean, talking about taking time to build character, Mud is that mm-hmm. for the first two-thirds of the movie.
For sure.
But then the dread does set in that last third. But it's really – and this is a thing that I want to get to. Your movies are all really coming-of-age films. In the case of Loving, it's the United States coming-of-age.
Well, that's a great way of putting it. Yeah.
But they're all these kind of stories about somebody having to mature.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also Richard having to do that, too. I mean, just to think he's had this life one way, you know, basically the life of a child, the life of privilege, the life of everything being given to him.
Hmm.
I mean, and suddenly he's thrown into the world of compromise.
For sure.
I mean, that schism between childhood and adulthood and that line being drawn, all of a sudden you're not a kid anymore.
Which you very much see in Mildred's progression. I mean, she begins as a 19-year-old girl who's just kind of excited about the idea of getting married and having a baby with this man that she loves, which I do think was very sincere and honest. But you see her imprisoned. You see her exiled. You see her begin to have these kids and slip into a depression while she's in D.C. You see this maturation that starts to take over her life. And then out of it, you see this clarity that comes with her understanding of her place in a movement that is much bigger than her, that is happening, I would say, from her point of view, very far away from her.
But she almost said, it's interesting, she had to go to D.C. to see, because had she stayed in Virginia, she could have been separated from it in that small town.
I think so. In that bubble that was Central Point, which was not even the town. Bowling Green was the town. They were from this, you know, outlier
Hamlet. Yes.
Hamlet. Yeah.
Yeah.
But even when she's in D.C., she's watching the march in 63. And, you know, when I was writing it, I had this idea that, you know, wouldn't it be neat, and I'm sure this will be an affectation, but wouldn't it be neat if we had a shot from the top of their row house and you could almost hear the din in the distance of the marches? Well, you know, I had Google Maps and I had their address and I was like, I don't know, it probably wouldn't really happen. But we sent a B-roll crew to their actual row house and they went up on the roof and they shot the shot that's in the film and you can see the Washington Monument. And I think that is literally how close she was, yet at the same time, from her perspective, felt very removed from it, you know? And how can those marches affect my life? But that started to that started to creep into her mind. And then it seemed to be this thing that grew and grew. She's still the same person. She's still very subtle. She's still very quiet. But a determination seemed to be brewing that was infectious and undeniable at some point. So by the end of the film, you have this woman that is really the spokesperson for not just her family, but for this idea. And that's a pretty cool character arc. You know, that's a pretty cool trajectory that is amazing to watch, I think, in such a encased in such this quiet, you know, reserved person. Something I was definitely attracted to.
We'll take a break. We're talking about Loving, but my guest certainly has made other films. He's Jeff Nichols. His new film as better director is Loving. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day. Find Today's Top Tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
My guest, who's raring to go, even as he has a sip of water there before we get started here, is Jeff Nichols. It's The Treatment. His new film as writer-director is Loving. And we were talking about coming-of-age stories. And these, again, this is for me. We talked about these other things before, but I wait to have you here to bring this up about the coming-of-age because I just wanted to just kind of spring it on you a little bit.
Yeah.
But that is finally the thing that so much Southern Gothic literature is about, the sort of that step into adulthood. And that's the real nameless dread of the world not belonging to you anymore.
Right.
And that's so much of what happens here. And this is the quietest film you've ever made.
Which is, you know, saying something because I've made some pretty quiet ones in the past. This is –
But, you know, at some point there's a storm or there's some there is some realization of external force, thing that people are afraid of. And because it's existed in such a – I'll mess up with this kindly – archetypal way in movies about race, you clearly chose to sort of do this in the way that almost Flannery O'Connor would.
Right.
And in terms of just sort of saying
– thank you for saying it.
I mean, if you look at those stories and there's one with a title I've talked about here before actually, The Artificial. But that's very much what that dread feels like
in this
movie. And I guess I saw you a couple of days ago and I saw Joel Edgerton as one of your stars. And he has to play a character unlike anybody who's ever played before. And you've even worked with him before and had him talk a lot.
Yeah, right.
And he's also a very chatty guy in person. He plays a guy who doesn't speak a whole lot here. And that frustration builds up for so many reasons because this is a guy who's incapable of expressing himself.
Sure, sure. It was a constant kind of calibration on our part, Joel and my part, I think, with portraying Richard. You know, he never went to high school. There were some serious questions about at what point does he understand what's going on and cannot enunciate it and is frustrated as a result? Or at what points, you know, does he not understand what's going on and is frustrated because it's over his head? There are different moments. And we kind of had to say for ourselves, I remember on set saying, okay, now where are we at here? How much is he getting out of this moment? Which were the vast majority of them, to be honest. You know, he understood, he had some basic knowledge and certainly some pretty fierce emotions about things, but completely incapable of articulating those. There's a scene particularly with a sheriff where he's in the sheriff's office. He has the argument that he wants to make. He's, in fact, probably been rehearsing it in his mind for the last couple of days while his wife has been languishing in jail. But when confronted both with that authority, which is a big part of that dynamic in that scene, but also just with the chance to speak up, the words aren't there for him. And to me, it's a very crushing scene for Joel. And he's there the whole time. There's this one very specific thing where he's not making eye contact. And the sheriff kind of starts to muse and his eyes kind of, you know, go off into the distance. And it's the one time where Joel takes an opportunity to look at the man that is kind of laying all of this stuff on him. But as soon as that sheriff's eyes come back, his eyes go down. You know, that is, as a director, I'm sitting back watching a really controlled performance. You know, that is someone very much thinking about all the moments that have no dialogue attached to them, you know. But then there are other scenes where he's sitting with lawyers and I think truly might not be understanding the complexities of things that are being talked about in front of him, especially as they relate to a bigger case and a bigger movement. And Joel, I think it's a tightrope performance, to be honest, that he may or may not get credit for because it's pretty darn subtle.
I think so too. And there's so many moments in the movie that are about that sort of frustration. But I was musing that I think part of it too becomes interesting because it must be his own frustration as an actor somehow he's able to channel into the performance, doesn't
it? Right. It's interesting working with Joel, and I found this on Midnight Special as well. You know, there is a mechanism at work when he's dealing with accent. And maybe every actor's dealing with it, but I felt like I noticed it more simply because of the voice. You speak to him, and he's a very jovial guy. He speaks with this great Australian accent. And so you see kind of the wheels turning in terms of what he has to do to capture this voice. And he does this thing. And he did it on Midnight Special as well. So he has, when he's building a voice, he pulls a real life example. And of course, on Loving, we had real examples of Richard. On Midnight Special, we took a clip from Errol Morris's documentary, The Thin Blue Line. There's a detective from Vidor, Texas. And right before a take, you would hear him saying this this monologue from The Thin Blue
Line. Speech, yeah.
You know, and which I know that very, very well. And so you're watching his process and then action, and it's somehow baked in to words that are completely different sentences, different, you know, structures and everything else. It's an impressive thing to watch, you know, but yeah, I'm a big fan of Joel's.
I'm talking to a fan of Joel Edgerton's, his director.
That's all I am.
Jeff Nichols. His new film as writer-director is Loving. It's The Treatment. It's interesting, too, because you've done something that people might say is kind of brave. You cast an Australian and a Brit in these two roles, and they're very American.
Well, you know, brave, I suppose. You know, Ruth was the first person we auditioned for this role. I wasn't familiar. Ruth Negga. She is incredible. A lot of people probably now know her from AMC's show The Preacher.
Yeah.
Which hadn't happened until we'd finished shooting our film. But I wasn't familiar with her. She came in, she started auditioning, and she just nailed it. You know, we had four or five scenes. We didn't really speak beforehand. She had been studying the documentary, studying the archival footage, and she had built the character. She had built, not the character, I always hate saying that. She built the person. And it wasn't until afterward that I started talking to her that she had an Irish accent, and I thought that was incredibly bizarre. but I had no control at that point because she was Mildred in my mind. So there was no real calculation there. With Joel, it was a bit more of a calculation because I knew him, I was working with him. But having watched how he treated that dialect, you know, and had taken those bits and pieces from The Thin Blue Line and created his own character out of it, I knew with this footage of Richard that we had, with these audio recordings and these photographs and footage, that he'd be able to build that character. So it really wasn't about finding people that had some innate understanding of how the South operated in America or the history there. It was really about the detail of how they would approach the performance. Say you cast, you know, an American actor with a great Southern accent. Okay, maybe they won't do that same amount of detail work to go become Richard in his voice. It's a weird accent. The Virginia accent has a huge coastal influence. They say about rather than about. Also, it's a period accent. So in my mind, I thought it was kind of the most obvious choice to take an actor who's going to have to do that dialect work, who's going to have to do that and is so used to doing it because they have to do it for, you know, the majority of their roles anyway, as opposed to getting an actor that might have a nice Southern accent, which what is that? You know, the South is not a monolith, and people from Arkansas sound quite different than people from Georgia or
people from D.C. sound quite different from people from Virginia, and I think of D.C. as being the South.
Absolutely. You know, it is not all one thing, and in this case, we had a very specific example of what Richard sounded like and what Mildred sounded like, so it made sense to go to actors that are used to, you know, just doing the work to nail those voices.
I guess I wondered too, because it feels like you maybe studied some of the old FSA photographs a little bit, some of those photographs of Dorothea Lange and and John Vachon and Gordon Parks, those photographs of the South, where you can almost see that the effect that poverty has on everybody, even though there's kind of gradations, is there's this people don't smile a whole lot.
Well, look, you know, I've heard some, you know, glancing blow critiques of like, why would you cast actors this old, you know, to play younger people? And like, look at the photographs. You know, Richard's in his mid-20s and looks ancient,
yes.
You know. But Harry Cruz writes about that. Harry Cruz writes about it's a rare life in the working class South not to, you know, be blinded by a glancing staple or, you know, it's just a hard life. And these people carry it on their faces, not to mention, and this is something we reduced in the film, but they're smoking the whole time, you know, and they're have beers in their hands the whole time. You know, it's just a harder life. And so, you know, that felt like a pretty appropriate decision.
No, I just feel like this film to me feels, and each film we see more and more this command and confidence and this one just feels like you had to make it this time because you wouldn't have been ready to make this film even 3 years ago.
No. And I could have said the same thing about Mud, and I could have said the same thing about Take Shelter. You know, like there's a reason for this trajectory, whether I control it totally or not. But no, it would have been a shame to have made this film second. You know, I think it wouldn't have had the discipline applied to it.
Had you been thinking about this subject for a while? I mean, it must have been a while ago you saw the documentary.
2012 is when I was first approached with it. I mean, I've been thinking about the subject of race for a very long time, but
given where you're from, I hope so.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I went to Little Rock Central High, the site of the desegregation crisis in 57. I graduated in 97. You know, you can't grow up in the South and not think about it and come to terms with it. You know, this was the time, though, to tackle this particular subject, but also because it's such a unique approach to it. One of the characters is white, so I have you know, some identifiable touch points there. The guy reminded me exactly of my grandfather. But also this community, you know, whenever I would talk to my dad, who grew up very poor in Altimer, Arkansas, which was a cotton town, I would always ask him, like, what, you know, tell me about it. Tell me about segregation. Tell me about the hardships. Like, I want to hear the stories. And he had them. But he would also always remind me, like, you have to remember, we lived together. I was poor and we didn't have anything to hold over anybody. And I played with white kids and I played with black kids. And it wasn't a way to diminish, you know, the tragedies of that period. But what he was just saying was there's a connectivity in these communities that you should not overlook or oversimplify. And when you look at the Lovings and when you look at Central Point as a very unique community in the South in the 50s and 60s, it spoke to that. And that was an idea. I had heard that back in junior high school, you know, and I watched the documentary and it's like, that's it. Like, that's the manifestation of that complexity in community. And it's something, as much as marriage equality and racial equality, it's something we need to be reminded of right now. You know, if you could, I live in Texas now, if you could wave a wand and like some people want to do and deport, you know, all of the Mexican illegal immigrants, the economy would collapse, you know.
But you also live in a town in Texas where if you go a half hour in any direction, it looks kind of like Virginia of that period.
For sure. You know, these complexities are things that I think that's what movies are for, you know. That's what storytelling is for, is to try and get people to recognize these movements and patterns. They're important.
I'm sorry, we're out of time. You've got to come back. It's always good to talk to you. It's nice to finally do it in front of the microphone. Thanks
so much
for doing this.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
My pleasure. My guest is the director and writer of the film Loving, Jeff Nichols. Our recording engineer here at KCRW is going to be back home is Kat York. It's edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I don't do anything with my hands. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new movie, The Greatest Hits. Music takes us places. What if it could literally take you back in time? The Greatest Hits is a hypnotic journey through the connection between love, music, and memory. Now streaming on Hulu.